News Power Hour.
Yeah, it's Wednesday the 9th of February. I'm Alec Hogg and it's my pleasure to be hosting the Hour of Power for you this evening. My colleague Michael Apple is in conversation with advocate Erin Richards. She wrote a cracking piece which is getting the tongues wagging amongst the BizNews community. Insights on what Bain did in the whole state capture issue. Also tonight, I spoke with a most interesting young man, Andrew Goodhead. He is going to be riding his bicycle from Cape Town all the way to the Drakensberg Sports Resort ahead of the BizNews Conference number 3. Hope you're going to be there with us. Also coming up tonight, it's from our colleagues at the Financial Times of London. The one is to do with the four-day working week. Is it coming? And news headlines that we get every day from the Financial Times. We're kicking off, as always, though, with my colleague Nadia Swart and the news headlines. BrightRock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity, and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets means change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
Politics and economics are set to collide over welfare payments in the world's most unequal nation. The first clue over which will prevail may come in President Cyril Ramaphosa's State of the Nation address on Thursday. Record unemployment and deepening poverty has fueled calls for the government to move toward a basic income grant, which would be the biggest of its kind globally. The debate has pitted Ramaphosa, who has said a basic income grant is a possibility and has raised the idea several times, against Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana, who's seeking to return government finances, hard hit by a decade of overspending, mismanagement and corruption, to a sustainable path. The Pretoria Society of Advocates is calling for the removal of Advocate Dali Mpofu from the Judicial Service Commission. Meanwhile, the General Counsel of the Bar said Mpofu brought the advocate's profession and the administration of justice into disrepute. The comments are tied to Mpofu's conduct during the JSC's interview process for the next Chief Justice. He and EFF leader Julius Malema blindsided candidates with unfounded allegations and insults with no evidence to back up the claims. Mpofu and Malema have been accused of character assassination and muddying the entire JSC process. Former DA mayor in Nelson Mandela Bay, Athol Trollope, has joined Action SA and wants to grow the political party's presence in the Eastern Cape ahead of the 2024 national elections. Trollope was announced as the newest member of the Green Party on Wednesday. The former DA member joins the party and automatically becomes Action SA's Eastern Cape chairperson. Trollope left the DA in 2019, citing policy decisions and concerns about the party's direction as the reason for his departure. And now it's on to my colleague Justin for the market report.
The JSE All Share Index is up at 76,400. In the price action, it's all about the paper and packaging manufacturers. Sappi coming out with great first quarter results, up 14%. Mondi following on the back of no specific company news. In the losers, Sasol down on a lower Brent crude price. And Telkom, the country's third largest telecommunications company, also down around 3% on the day. And lastly, the Geltech crypto basket is down 5% for the day. In the currency markets, the rand is stronger against all the major currencies, to 15 rand 34 cents to the dollar, 20 rand 82 cents to the pound, and 17 rand 54 cents to the euro. Gold is up at $1,830 an ounce. Kruger rand will cost you around 29,500 rand. Brent crude is trading at $91 a barrel. The premier cryptocurrency will put you back 680,000 rand. In the financial news, Just Share, the shareholder activist group, has accused Standard Bank of isolating itself from its peers by continuing to flirt with financing carbon-intensive projects, even as its main rivals spurn such deals amid growing climate change concerns. Last week, French and Chinese oil giants Total signed the final investment decision to proceed with the East African crude oil pipeline project, a planned $10 billion deal on which Standard Bank, shareholder Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, is listed as an advisor. The controversial project aims to tap the oil reserves of poverty-stricken Uganda and transport the fuel more than 1,400 kilometers across the East African nation, as well as neighboring Tanzania, where it'll be exported from the port of Tanga. However, detractors argue that the project will displace small-scale farmers and poses a serious risk to wildlife and sensitive Eastern African ecosystems at a time when much of the world is looking to reduce its reliance on fossil fuels.
This daily market report was made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes. As promised, our featured interview of the day is with my colleague Michael Apple and advocate Aaron Richards.
Aaron, welcome. It's the first time that I've had an opportunity to interview you. Thanks for coming through to our studios.
Fantastic to be here. Thanks, Mike.
Before we get into why you're here, which is to discuss an opinion piece you've written, it's up on biznews.com. Go check that out. For somebody who doesn't watch the news and doesn't know who or what Bain and Company is and what two commissions of inquiry have found them to be implicated in, just lay that foundation for us.
Mike, very simply, without going into too much unnecessary detail, we're all au fait with the extent to which state capture has grasped this country. And long story short, Bain has been seriously implicated in that state capture. Specifically, the focus to date has been on its work at SARS. It consulted at SARS for a period of roughly 27 months between 2015 and 2017. And during that time, there was basically a wholesale destruction of SARS, including its enforcement units that focused on organized crime. So we've had two commissions of inquiry, first the Nugent Commission and now the State Capture Commission, that have seriously implicated Bain in state capture.
You have written and opined asking the question whether there is a link between Bain and Company, their capture of SARS, and the possible advancement of the illicit economy or organized crime. That's quite a space to venture into. What sparked this idea?
Mike, look, in all honesty, it wasn't a comfortable piece for me to write. But while I was reading Athol Williams' testimony, I came across evidence of an email chain dated 2015 that basically was setting up a meeting between senior South African police officials, Interpol, senior Italian police officials, our Minister of Police, and representatives from Beretta, the firearms company. Bain was the one organizing that meeting. That really grabbed my attention, and it's got me asking some what I think are some very serious and important questions. And I always found it curious that when Bain was consulting to SARS, one of the hallmarks of that period was the wholesale destruction of SARS's enforcement units. And I'd never really understood that. Why was it? Why was there this necessity, this extreme pursuit of destroying SARS's enforcement units? And when I read those emails, I just wondered if there might have been a connection between illicit trade and organized crime and this destruction of SARS's enforcement units. So that's what got it started.
How did these emails come to light?
There are one of two options, and I'm not entirely sure which one it is. Here's what happened. After the Nugent Commission, which first implicated Bain, Bain did two things. First, it asked Athol Williams to come and perform basically an ethical oversight role in the organization. And it contracted Baker McKenzie to do an investigation into its work with SARS. Now, the documents, these emails, either came from Bain and were given to Athol, or they came from Baker McKenzie and were given to Athol. Not to put too fine a point on it, we don't know, we haven't been able to verify these emails yet, and they weren't, unfortunately, properly interrogated in the Zondo Commission. So just so your audience knows, we're working on the assumption that these are legitimate emails, but that legitimacy hasn't been tested yet.
It hasn't been tested, but it also hasn't been challenged. And that's an important point to make.
Yes, very much. And thank you for that. I mean, if we look at the State Capture Commission, Bain initially wanted to cross-examine Athol Williams when he gave his testimony after blowing the whistle. Then Bain was told by the Zondo Commission that they were welcome to cross-examine Ethel Williams, but that then they would also have to put their version in front of the commission. And after they were told that, they withdrew their application to cross-examine. And so we have not actually had Bain's side of the story here.
I want to take us to one line in the emails and get your response and your thoughts on that. Now, who's speaking here is Vittorio Massone. He was one of the Bain SA partners. And he's writing to Beretta, the Italian arms manufacturer's Dr. Micheletti. Quote, "I am only an intermediary, and these gentlemen are very structured and diligent. Isn't it nice to know that? Right now, indeed, they are also obsessed with wiretapping. It's been a year trying to take out the commissioner." Now, the commissioner at the time, in September 2015, was Ria Piecha. Just by chance or happenstance, she would be suspended a month later. And that is assuming that this meeting takes place. But that is a concerning line. Quote, "It has been a year trying to take out the commissioner." And if you look at the timeline, at the time, that's Ria Piecha. Is that a worrying line to you?
Look, there are many, many worrying things about this meeting and the email chains, and that's certainly one of them. You know, firstly, this reference to wiretapping is suspect. If you're not doing anything illegal or anything shady, why are you worried about wiretapping? Second, this reference to the commissioner at the time, who, as you point out, was subsequently suspended, that indicates that Bain has inside knowledge that it shouldn't have. So the fact that this entire discussion was even happening is highly irregular and raises very many questions.
Another line that stands out to me is, once again, Massone writing to Beretta, and he says, "One of the important terms is public order policing, and the issue of non-lethal weapons is very important to position Beretta. They have received specific instructions from the president to withdraw and replace the RS. Now, the RS-200 or RS-202 is a shotgun. Are we talking about President Jacob Zuma here, do you think?
It certainly seems that way. I'm not sure which other president we would be referring to. You know, but this to me is very concerning, because essentially what's being discussed here is some kind of procurement. Okay, so it looks like there was at some point a policy decision to move away from lethal weapons to possibly less lethal or non-lethal weapons. And that's why there is this phrase by Massone where he says that Beretta should position itself around non-lethal firearms. So essentially what you've got here is Beretta coming in to have a discussion, it looks like, with the minister at the time about a procurement issue. Now, that is highly irregular. Ministers don't get involved in procurement. Procurement happens through procurement officers at the various departments and SOEs. This is fertile ground for corruption, is when you start having ministers meeting with people like firearms traders.
Just to point out, we have reached out to one of the parties named in the emails, and he has absolutely no recollection of such a meeting ever taking place. He is certainly one of the people who is named as the contact person by Bain. Get in touch with Mr. Molati Moremi, who was head of stakeholder relations in the police ministry. I reached out to him and I said, "Have you ever had anybody from Bain contact you? What was this meeting all about? Did it occur?" I'm not exactly pleading the fifth, but I cannot recall, was the response there.
Yes, and I always love those responses, because it's not an admission, but it's also not a denial.
Yeah. Now on Monday, Lord Peter Hain, he writes an opinion piece. It gets carried by the Financial Times, a very influential publication in Europe, at least. And he calls on the UK government, the US government, to cut ties, to freeze out Bain because of the findings from both the Nugent and the state capture inquiry. And he wants the US, because it's a Boston-based company, even though they are global, to withdraw the license from Bain to operate. What do you think of Lord Haynes' calls in the Financial Times?
I think it's extremely necessary, and I wish that there was more similar action actually happening in South Africa. There was more boycotting of Bain. Essentially, what Lord Hain is doing is he's applying significant public pressure and international pressure to Bain. And South Africa, as the place where all of this malfeasance happened in the first place, should have been the first to hop on board that train. But unfortunately, we haven't seen that. You know, one would think that with the amount of evidence that's been brought forward by Bain's obfuscatory conduct, their clear non-compliance with our laws, with our constitution, one would have thought we would have seen a mass boycott. We would have seen people who had contracts with Bain finding lawful ways to withdraw from those contracts. We would have hoped to have seen people resigning from Bain South Africa. But instead, we haven't. We've just carried on as normal, which I find concerning and honestly quite disappointing. So I'm very grateful to people like Lord Hain and Athol Williams, who continue to raise that alarm bell internationally.
So here's an eye-watering figure for you that Lord Hain threw out yesterday in an interview with Alec Hogg, the editor here. He said that Bain had made £55 million from doing work for the British government over the last few years. He wasn't explicit about an exact time frame. And that equals 1.14 trillion rand. Let's compare that to the fees that Bain derived at the South African Revenue Service. Paltry, 167 million rand.
Well, here's something that also to me just makes very little sense. I mean, look, firstly, I don't think it was just 167. I think Bain has been, that was one project. You know, I suspect that Bain consults or has been consulting quite broadly across state entities and for a protracted period of time. So I think that there's significantly more money at play. And also, if we look at these emails and the meeting that we think might have happened and Bain's role, it also raises the question about whether or not there are illegitimate kickbacks that are being paid either to Bain or to its employees. So who knows how much of our money they've got.
You speak about the possibility of them having done work at other state-owned entities or in government departments. Do we actually know where Bain has worked or where they are currently still working?
No, exactly. And this is a serious bone of contention for me, and it's something that drives me nuts. And it's why I always advocate for transparency, transparency, transparency. Give us the details. I mean, this is one of those moments where there should be full and frank disclosure about where Bain has worked 1994 onwards and where they are working now. Why is this information not forthcoming? Why is no one pushing for this? Why is Parliament not asking the questions? Why are the opposition parties not asking? I mean, it's an obvious, obvious question, and it is hugely important. And so this is why I'm so concerned about this email, because what we're seeing here is not the full picture. It's a microcosm of a macro situation. And the only reason we know about Bain and SARS is because Athol Williams had the courage to blow the whistle. So what we need to do is look at Bain. We need to interrogate and investigate as much as we can, work out what happened, work out the patterns of corruption that manifested, and then we need to start extrapolating. And we need to start looking at whether that has happened in other consulting firms, in other auditing firms, if their pattern manifests in the banks, the law firms. Hopefully, we will get whistleblowers coming out more frequently after Athol's kind of, you know, lit the torch and led the way. But this is an opportunity. We need to not take a siloed approach and think that it's just Bain and just SARS, because I don't think it is. I think it's much deeper, much, much deeper than that.
Well, Athol Williams says it would work to Bain's advantage if you just cast the eye at SARS.
Well, that's one of Bain's angles. Bain's other angle is first look at SARS, and if you must look at us, look at one of our employees, Mr. Vittorio Massone. And whoops, sorry, but he went rogue, and it's not our fault. Bain is not corrupt. Maybe there was a problem with Massone. Sorry about that, but he's gone. Okay. Still consulting to a company that has offices in South Africa, but be that as it may. So Bain has adopted a strategy of epic deflection. And anyone who believes, given the evidence that we've seen, that the problem was one man, Mr. Vittorio Massone, it's not a viable proposition at all. I mean, it's clear from some of the contracts that Bain was concluding and the approval processes that those contracts had to go through, that those contracts, dodgy as they were, had to work their way up to international partners at Bain, senior management internationally at Bain. So people knew what was happening here and they signed off on it. And those issues need to be investigated. And then we need to take that and look at this meeting in the context of everything else that's unfolded.
Yeah, Athol Williams says Vittorio Massone was celebrated from Boston. You could hear the cheers because of all the money the man was generating for Bain through various projects, there was something called a President's Project, and, yes, and that alluded to President Jacob Zuma. I want to ask you about, they've been found to be unscrupulous. The State Capture Inquiry said that many of their actions were unlawful. How do you deal with private sector companies like this? Do you cut them off at the knees? And I ask this in particular because if we look at Bell Pottinger and the immense harm that it did to South Africa, heinous campaigns it ran, immoral, you wouldn't be allowed to operate anymore. Their license was withdrawn and they have closed down. Mm-hmm. Should Bain's executives in Boston, including Mr. Massone, drag him out of Italy, put them before a court of law here, and then test this version and then make findings against him? Is that something that has to happen so that South Africa can get over this? Because Bain's mea culpa, it just doesn't seem to be enough.
Look, I mean, as for what we can do, there are numerous prongs to this answer. The first is what the state can do. Under South African law, you can prosecute a company and employees criminally. So we could do both. Technically, we could go after Bain, we could go after Missone, we could go after whoever else is implicated through these investigations at Bain. Obviously, if you're going to go after individuals like Vittorio Missone, you're going to have to use the Extradition Act to extradite him and bring him back to South Africa to face trial. But all of that would only happen after a very, very extensive investigation. And we don't even know at this point if that investigation is going to happen. It is a recommendation in the Zondo report. We'll see what the president's response to that is.
Okay, so I want to go over to Bain's statement because it is important to put their side across as well. They released a statement in the wake of the findings of the Nugent Commission, and a lot of it was a cut and paste job, to be honest. If you look at the very latest statement, when they were deciding whether or not to be a member of Business Leadership South Africa.
Yeah.
So here it goes, quote, the commission's hearings, and it's referring to Nugent here, and the final report published last week have laid bare the disarray in which SARS now finds itself, with both moral and performance severely damaged. Contributing to that outcome was not the intent of the Bain Project, and we clearly made significant errors of judgment in taking on this work. As a firm, we have been shocked and saddened by our involvement with SARS. We let down our clients, our people, our alumni. Most of all, we've let you down, South Africa. We accept that through various lapses in leadership and governance, Bain South Africa became an unwitting participant in the process that inflicted serious damage on South Africa. Heartfelt?
No. And my response to that is, yes, you have let South Africa down and you should bugger off. And if they don't want to, then we should kick them out. That should be our response. You know, as much as we hope that law enforcement and the NPA do their investigations and pursue the prosecutions, we as South Africans also need to start standing up and saying, if we want to protect our constitution, if we want to protect an ethical society, then we need to act ethically. And part of that is, if you are associated with people like Bain, when you find out what they're up to, get them out. Get rid of them. You know, that's the second leg in our own personal responsibility that we all carry. As for whether that's heartfelt, no, I don't think it is. As for whether it's accurate, no, I don't think it is. I don't buy for a second that they are shocked and saddened by anything. This looks to me like it was intentional. And this potential meeting that may or may not have happened in 2015 also raises some very serious questions, because if it turns out that Bain or its employees were somehow profiting from organized crime, then it would make sense that they so ruthlessly pursued the destruction of SARS's enforcement units. So I don't buy for a single second that there was any lapse in judgment. To me, on the evidence that I've seen it, as it stands uncontradicted by Bain at this point in time, it seems to me that there's something far more dubious at play.
Well, let's just remind the person watching here that Bain was in contact with President Jacob Zuma and Tom Moyane far in advance of him, yes, becoming the SARS commissioner. Now, they had no business talking to Tom Moyane, but it seems that they had the inside track on who he was going to become, the position he was going to be appointed to, and they were just helping him figure out what he needed to do as part of a restructuring agenda when he became the boss there.
Correct.
So we're not thinking anything up here. This is not in the ether.
No.
This is all coming out of the commissions of inquiry.
Correct. You know, and I mean the whole chain of events just speaks to coordination. You know, firstly it's 2010 and Vittorio Masone arrives in South Africa. About a year and a half, 2 years later, he starts having multiple meetings with the president and also Tom Moyane during the same period, although maybe a little bit later. But at the time of those meetings, there was no contract with the South African government in place. No reason at all for a consulting firm or partner at a consulting firm to be meeting with the president. And Athol Williams made this patently clear in his evidence. He said that he could think of no legitimate reason for such meetings, especially in the absence of any contract. And you're right, Bain seemed to know about Tom Moyane's appointment many months before he was actually given that appointment. So, you know, if you start connecting the dots here, it becomes very difficult to believe that all of this was a lapse in judgment. What did you meet the president out of a lapse of judgment? Did you not know that was irregular and that shouldn't be happening? Do you know that we have a constitution? Do you know that we have procurement laws? It just doesn't make sense. The version makes no sense at all.
Well, Bain had managed to hook a very big fish here under this president's project. And Mr. Masone wrote quite openly in his emails back to Boston about the progress he was making with former President Jacob Zuma.
Mm.
So when we speak about this particular email and the September 2015 meeting, whether or not it took place, where they referred to a president there, the only reasonable inference one can draw there is not the president of Beretta or the president of Business Leadership South Africa. Mm. It's the president of the Republic.
Correct, yeah.
Have you had a chance to have a look at the opinion piece Athol Williams has written recently?
No, I haven't read it yet. I have seen that it's up on the website, but I haven't been able to go through it yet.
Perfect, because that's a very nice segue into how we end this. And that is, we are going to hope to get Athol Williams, the Bain whistleblower, on this program next week. And then the three of us can have a nice conversation. I want to end by quoting from Zondo's first report in relation to Bain. And it says, quote, "One of the few instances where President Zuma was himself directly and personally involved in the activities and plans to take over a government entity. And Bain's involvement is a clear example of how the private sector colluded on state capture."
Andrew Goodhead, you are going to be making an adventure to the BizNews conference, riding 1,500 kilometers from Cape Town. What made you want to do this?
How's it, Alec? It's good to be here. Thanks for having me around. I really love BizNews. I have always wanted to attend a BizNews conference, and it was on a long day at work that I decided it was time to go, but I needed an exciting way of getting there.
Why? I mean, most people are going to get on an aeroplane or drive their cars.
I've always loved cycling. Tour cycling is my passion. It's quite a phenomenal opportunity to be able to be going slow enough to experience the surroundings, but fast enough to actually get there.
Tour cycling, is it a big thing?
Tour cycling is a big thing. It involves carrying all your equipment on your bike, very much like hiking, but you're on a bicycle.
Oh, this is a mountain bike, not a motorbike.
Not a motorbike, a bicycle, yeah, pedal power.
But you are going to get a bit of assistance. You're not pedaling the whole way.
I'll be pedaling the whole way, but I'll have some assistance. I'm going to be riding an e-bike, but I'm going with an e-bike and a difference. I'm going to be towing behind me a solar panel, and the solar panel will charge the battery as I ride and make it a bit faster and sort of an off-grid e-bike experience.
Are e-bikes usually internal combustion engines or other type of engines?
You do get petrol-powered sort of assistance. They're known as the old mopeds. But this one is a battery-powered electric bicycle.
Okay, so this is battery-powered, but on top of that, it's solar battery-powered.
Yes, a normal e-bike could last maybe, I don't know, 30, 40 kilometers until the battery is drained. And I'm going to be cycling 220, 230 kilometers per day. I don't have the time to wait for the batteries to charge, and there isn't really a grid to plug into in the middle of the Karoo. So I'll be carrying my own charging capacity in the form of solar panels.
Mopeds go quite quickly. How fast does your e-bike travel?
I can travel up to about 50 kilometers per hour. At that speed, my legs just start spinning. But I'll be trying to maintain a speed of sort of 25 to 30 kilometers. That would put me on the saddle for about 8 hours a day. If I go any slower, the sun will set before I get to my bed at the end of the day.
How do you train for something like this?
I haven't done that much training, but I've done a lot of cycling in my life. I cycle to work every day and then just some stuff on the weekends.
Andrew, we're talking about 8 hours in the saddle every day for 7 days.
That's right.
That's a heck of a
journey. There'll be a sore bum at the end.
And where are you going to stay along the route?
I'm going to be staying with BizNews community members. So the BizNews tribe have been very generous in offering accommodation. And I'll be staying
in and hot meals, I hope, and a hot shower after 8 hours in the saddle.
Yes, I think they will be more grateful for me having a hot shower than me.
Have you got a decent seat? I mean, I just think of a bicycle saddle in 8 hours a day.
I have my favorite seat, and it's been with me on a lot of adventures. My bum sort of
it's comfortable
formed its
then.
Shape. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's understand. You're leaving Cape Town on a Sunday, and you're going to arrive at the Drakensberg Sports Resort on the Monday.
Yes.
And we'll all be there. The whole BizNews team will be there, and the Drakensberg Sports Resort staff. We're all going to be waiting for you, so you'll get a good reception.
As I limp in.
But along the route, what do you do? Is it an opportunity to maybe think a lot? What keeps your mind busy during those long days?
I'll be sure to be listening to the Power Hour.
So you're going to have podcasts on?
I'll definitely have podcasts.
Good, good.
It's a routine in my life anyway, so that'll be something to keep me going. And then South Africa is a beautiful place, and there's beautiful people. So I will be taking in the scenery and chatting to all the people I meet en route. I'll also be taking special notes of some features along the way. I'm a civil engineer, and I find bridges quite fascinating. So both the bridges and the road surface will be of particular interest to me and my bum.
That's your bum. It's quite interesting you talk about bridges, because there are some pretty old bridges along the routes that you're going to be going. Is there historical interest for a civil engineer to actually stop and have a look at the way that they used to build bridges maybe 100 years ago?
Absolutely. There's an old technique called dry packing. They don't use any cement, and it's just the friction of the rocks. It's a phenomenal art that we've lost, unfortunately. There's a whole website dedicated to mountain passes of South Africa with a historic write-up of the particular passes. So I'll be passing through a few. One of the big ones is Oberg Pass from the Tankwa Karoo up into Sutherland. It's a big hill, and I'm excited to slog it out.
Well, I hope it's not raining or that there's a lot of cloud cover that day, because you're going to certainly, on a big hill, need the support that you can get from your E part of the bike.
The solar part, yes. With the collection capacity that I have, I'll be towing behind 2.5 square meters of solar panel, and that will give me about 360 watts at peak performance. And to put that into context, a professional cyclist like Chris Froome can put out about 400 watts continually. So I'll have almost a Chris Froome to help me out in the middle of the day. Obviously, during the morning and evenings, the power is reduced quite significantly to zero.
Andrew, I'm just trying to think about when you go through the Karoo, where it is really hot at the end of February. Are you, during that time, going to be able to go faster if the sun is beating down?
The power is going from the panels straight into the battery, and then I can draw it as I want. So not necessarily faster, but my battery will be charging more during the peak hours of the day. And then I'll use the battery as I need as I go up a hill, or if there's a headwind, the rest of the time I'll be pedaling to keep it going.
What about things like sunburn or refreshments along the way?
That's a real thing. A athlete needs the sustenance. So I'll be wearing long sleeves, sun cream. I've made a cool rim for my helmet. So it's a helmet with a hat, and then just good old water and potatoes, future life. I enjoy future life. Yeah, good food.
So you're going to also be taking wine to share with Biz News community members who have kindly offered a bed and a hot plate.
A friendly house. Absolutely. I'll be leaving from the Cape, so it's only fitting that I take some of the Cape's goods along with me and share the joy that the Cape produces. So hopefully each night there'll be good conversation and we'll share some rational perspective on on the journey.
Oh boy, you say all the right things. And we're going to be sharing some chats as well. You and I will be talking at each of your stops. What are you going to be looking out for that we can discuss in those little crossings?
Yeah, I look forward to engaging with the community. It'll be a long, maybe lonely road in the Karoo. So it's good to know that there's support from the Biz News tribe. I'll be passing many interesting things, the landscape, lots of sheep, maybe a few eagles. And one of the most interesting things will be the solar stats of how much I'm collecting. And that'll be a more technical interest of, is this actually a viable option to go off grid and for people in remote communities? Is this something that could happen more regularly?
The third Biz News conference at the magnificent Champagne Sports Resort in the Drakensberg will be held from the 1st to the 4th of March. It's lining up to be the best so far. We've got a strong lineup of speakers. A single delegate cost is $7,750. For couples, it's $12,950. Book your seat by going onto the Biz News Investment Conference button on the right-hand side of the biznews.com homepage. See you there. You're listening to the Biz News Power Hour, brought to you by the team at biznews.com.
Hello and welcome to Working It. I'm Isabel Barrick. Today's episode's about the four-day week, meaning getting paid a full-time wage for only 80% of the original hours. Understandably, it's a very popular option among a lot of workers and a less popular working style for employers, many of whom tend to have a long list of arguments for why it wouldn't work for them.
Now, the other one is productivity. Well, how do you measure productivity? What that says is you're not measuring productivity. You're using time as a surrogate. And then it translates to, well, I'd have to recruit 20% more people, or I can't close my company for a day. I don't close my company for a day. People will say size. Well, Unilever's doing it. Microsoft's doing it. Manufacturing won't work. Volkswagen are doing it. And then the final one, which is usually the killer, is, well, it wouldn't work in medicine. Well, medicine's already using shifts, point number one. Point number two, the Americans, good example, kill 250,000 people in their health service every year as a consequence of misdiagnosis occasioned by stress and overwork. And you only have to answer the question, do you want to be operated on by the doctor who's been working 20 hours straight or the one who's fresh?
That's Andrew Barnes. He's very enthusiastic about the four-day week, and he would be. He's essentially a salesman for the concept. He runs 4-Day Week Global, a group that lobbies, produces research, and assists businesses in implementing reduced hours. He became really passionate about the concept after he stumbled across the idea while reading a magazine on a flight.
I was reading a couple of articles about British productivity, and this is back in 2017, and they were saying that the Brits were productive for 2.5 hours a day, and the Canadians for 1.5 hours a day. And I wondered why that was happening. I wondered if that was happening in my business, and I wondered what would happen if I changed how people worked, whether in fact I would get better productivity rather than less productivity if I went to a 4-day week.
The business he's referring to there is Andrew's main business. So well before 4-day week global was imagined, Andrew was the founder of Perpetual Guardian, which is New Zealand's largest statutory trust fund. That means it manages wills, trusts and estate planning for many families in the country. And did you take any advice from the many consultancies on this, or did you just go for it with a pilot?
I winged it. I would love to say that, you know, this was a really planned thing. I got off the plane. I phoned my head of HR and said, I've got a great idea. I think we'll do a four-day week. And sort of there was dead silence on the phone. Well, by the time I got back, she deleted every email I'd sent on this and was working on the assumption that I was mad and that I'd forgotten about it. And unfortunately, I came back and said, no, I've put it on a post-it note. Let's try the four-day week. As far as the board were concerned, I announced it on national television before I told them.
When the workers started on this, were they cautious? I mean, it seems like a sort of almost too good to be true situation. Were people hesitant about taking up the offer?
Somebody videoed the actual original announcement, and there is cautious laughter when we talk about it. Because obviously, you're right. I mean, why would somebody give me a day off a week? There's got to be a catch. And obviously, people start to think maybe it's about job cuts, maybe it's about pay cuts. But what I was saying to the team is, look, this is an honest compact between me and you. I think that this will be better for you working 4 days. Equally, it's got to be just as good for me. I've got to get the same thing out of it that I otherwise would have got from a 5 day week. So, you know, it starts a very open conversation. The next thing is, I have no idea how to implement it. And this is up to you. This is up to you to think about what you will do, as a team, what you will do personally differently in order to deliver this concept we have of the 180-100. 100% pay, 80% time, but provided we get 100% productivity.
So Andrew's saying there quite rightly that for this to work anywhere, it's got to work for everybody, in business included. So I'm joined now by Emma Jacobs, FT journalist and Working It regular, who's going to help me crack this one open. Emma, Andrew's already explained a few reasons why people think this won't work in their company. Have you heard of any others?
I mean, I thought it was really interesting. The exceptionalism is the big issue. I think lots of companies believe that it won't work in their industry and so they can't possibly do it. So I think that inertia is a real issue. And I think that it's interesting to see how it's changed over the pandemic, if it's shifted at all.
Has it shifted at all in the pandemic? What are you seeing?
I mean, I've seen more companies try four-day weeks. There was one company that tried it initially to cut pay. So it was 80% working week for 80% of the pay. And then actually, they've realised that productivity wasn't affected and actually it would be a perk that they could use as a thank you to say, right, we'll restore it to 100% of pay. And that's been gladly received. And another company realised that with remote working that they were going to have to play around with their perks. And one way of doing that was to introduce a four-day week so that they could compete with a capital city that was further away.
Right. And Andrew says his team's productivity is up 25%. But in things like factories or big companies where they have a big turnover of staff, would it work as well? I'm not sure.
I mean, I think there's no reason why it couldn't work. I mean, I think that they're already doing shifts. They know how to slice and dice these working arrangements. I think the problem often is that lots of employees want more hours rather than less because they need the money. So I think there's a real inequity when it comes to hours. And I think often some of these companies are trying the head office as 4 day working weeks, and then everybody on the shop floor, for example, then does a 5 day working week, which seems quite unfair.
Yeah, I'd be not that happy if I was left on 5 days while everyone went to the pub on the fifth day at head office. So one thing I wondered is how this model has fared during COVID, because we've seen time and time again that people are working longer hours generally. And I guess the question is it even realistic to maintain 4 days during a crisis? Here's Andrew on what's happened recently.
If anything, I think what COVID has done is accelerated the process. If you'd have asked me 3 years ago that congressmen in the States would be dropping a bill in to legislate for reduced hours working, or you'd have the well-publicised trials in Iceland, Ireland, Scotland, the legislation that's coming through in Russia, I'd have said, you're joking, this is a long burn. But what COVID has done is, first of all, it's made people focus on how they want to work. And it's empowered workers, the great resignation all over the world. You ask a worker what they want to do, they want to work less. The next thing that's happened is that we've suddenly had to make our companies work in a different way. We've also had people who are, you know, out of the loop, either because they're isolating, they've got COVID, or they're looking after family members. Now, bizarrely, the four-day week is a construct. And we don't close for a day, but for example, we operate the normal five-day week. But because we operate in a way with people rotating out all the time, we actually, pre-COVID, found our company was far more resilient. So when we went through the lockdown here in New Zealand, all but about 200,000 people in the country were taking government subsidy. We got two record months and 1 month where we missed a record by $27,000 and didn't take a cent. So it makes your company stronger and better in the modern world, bizarrely. And I think people are now starting to see that.
Emma, do you think what Andrew says is realistic on a big scale? You know, has the COVID empowered staff to ask to work less? Is it linked to the Great Resignation, do you think?
I mean, I think it's a very difficult position for employees to ask for less working time, but it is a way of kind of solving a pay conundrum, I guess, which is to work reduced hours for the same amount of pay. But I think generally, it has instigated a way of thinking about the working week. And we've seen with Arup, for example, doing the 7 day week, or other companies doing 4 day working weeks, or companies doing sort of compressed office hours and the flexibility to work around those hours, meaning that people are being more experimental with time as well as place, which has had a lot of the focus of kind of flexible work discussions around COVID.
Yeah, I think we are moving on to a time discussion, which I think is really helpful. And I'm interested that his office doesn't close. So I think that's probably the way to do it, isn't it? That you never close your office. It's just that people are telling each other when they're going to be there. But is there a risk in this that we go back to this idea of time? You know, 4 days could mean four 12-hour days, which rather removes the point of it.
I mean, I think there is a risk, but I think in some ways there's more of a risk when people have different arrangements. So often women who've gone part-time, not speaking from experience, obviously lots of women end up doing five-day weeks for 4 days pay, and that is pretty miserable experience. So I think in some ways, although it is entirely possible that everyone ends up doing, you know, the same hours as they were doing before, that if you actually universalize it, then it makes it everybody's problem to manage, and that it's visible instead of being these kind of hidden arrangements that one individual has to bear because they've had the favor of having reduced hours.
Yeah. And it's interesting, I was thinking back, there are some jobs where they give you Friday afternoon off and have done for a long time. I'm thinking of some publishers in London. I would often get an email on a Friday afternoon saying, we don't work Friday afternoons during the summer. And I just thought, how brilliant is that?
I mean, there are some jobs where there's a kind of, you know, my client wants me now, so I must respond at all times. But if you're clear about when you're not available and that everybody has to agree to that, including the clients, except for urgent projects, I think that there can be some sort of curtailment of office hours. I think that the problem is there's a sort of slippage in that every project is important and there's some sort of wiggle room that gets people out of it.
Yeah, I think the pressure from clients is often cited as a reason for not doing compressed or shorter hours. And it was interesting to hear what Andrew had to say about the challenges they faced.
One of the challenges is that quite often this debate comes from the left, comes from a demand for reducing hours. And inevitably, that pushes companies to the other side of the ledger and the right. And what we're trying to do is saying, actually, it has all of the social benefits, but this is fundamentally a brilliant business strategy. A brilliant business strategy. You get better staff retention. You can attract better staff. Your sick days half, and your productivity goes up by anything up to 50%. What's not to like as a business strategy? So if we can phrase it that way, we've got more chance, I think, of businesses all over the world saying, you know what, let's follow the idea that Henry Ford had 100 years to reduce the working week from 6 to 5. let's actually reduce it from 5 to 4 or from 40 hours to 32. And the benefits that we will get, the world will get, will be absolutely material.
You're listening to the BizNews Power Hour, brought to you by the team at biznews.com.
Today is Wednesday, February 9th, and this is your FT News Briefing. Credit Suisse investors want its vice chair gone as the lender tries to get out from under a pile of scandals, and one of Britain's most successful tech companies may list on the NASDAQ after a mammoth deal fell through. Plus, efforts to find a solution to the UK's migrant crisis have frozen.
Nobody in this situation, certainly on the UK side, has any of the political imagination or daring to take the kinds of steps that would actually be effective.
We'll explain why London and Paris can't come up with any solutions. I'm Mark Filippino, and here's the news you need. Investors at Credit Suisse are impatient. They really want the scandal-ridden bank to clean up its act, and they want to start by pushing out its vice chair, Severin Schwan. Two top shareholders told the FT that they would vote to block any move to extend the tenure of the bank's longtime vice chair. Schwan is also CEO of the Swiss pharma group Roche, and investors aren't confident he can steer the bank and lead the drug maker at the same time. Shares in Credit Suisse have tumbled more than 60% since Schwan joined the board in 2014. We reported yesterday that Credit Suisse has become the first Swiss bank in the country's history to get hit with criminal charges for allegedly helping a Bulgarian mafia launder money. The bank releases its annual results on Thursday. The head of SoftBank, Masayoshi Son, spent the last year and a half trying to sell the British chip company Arm to Nvidia. It would have been a record-breaking deal, but it collapsed late Monday. And now, the FT reports, SoftBank may take Arm public in the US. And that could be a huge disappointment to the UK.
This is absolutely fascinating because it's all tangled up with nationalism and the politics around Brexit.
The FT's Richard Waters reminds me that SoftBank's original purchase of the British chip company Arm, right after the UK voted to leave the European Union, was seen as a huge vote of confidence in British industry. Selling it to the US company Nvidia, well, it would have been hard to swallow.
So there'll be relief now that Arm isn't going to be bought by an American company. But it's going to have to stand on its own feet. And, you know, that presents all kinds of other problems.
One of which is where it will list. Again, you've got the US and the UK.
Within Britain, there's been a real desire for a while to get Arm listed on the London stock market. It would be a real symbol of, you know, British technology success. But as we report in the FT yesterday, SoftBank wants to list this company in New York because it knows that that's where it'll get a higher valuation. British investors have not shown themselves over the last year to be, you know, really open to the kind of, quite honestly, quite stretched valuations that tech stocks have achieved compared to the US. And SoftBank knows very clearly where it will get the best deal.
Richard Waters is the FT's West Coast editor. He covers all things tech. Britain's relations with France are at their lowest point in decades. And a big reason for that is the issue of migrants. The number of migrants seeking asylum in the UK has reached levels not seen since the 2015 Syrian refugee crisis. Many come from France, often in boats across the English Channel. It's a huge hot-button issue, and officials from the two countries haven't been able to see eye to eye.
At this point, we call it ping-pong. The UK blames the French blame the British.
In our third and final report on the UK migrant crisis, we'll speak to a leading expert and find out what could be done. First, here's the FT's social policy correspondent, Robert Wright, on why British officials aren't coming up with solutions and just reaching for a harsh deterrent approach.
Nobody in this situation, certainly on the UK side, has any of the political imagination or daring to take the kinds of steps that would actually be effective. There's not that much downside in just refusing to budge. It looks like they're being cruel, which probably to some people looks like an effective strategy. And flexibility just doesn't have any real political upside for them. So I think they'll just dig in. You'll still have people coming across. They'll seek to put them into horrible accommodation, seek to be unpleasant to them. I would think that not terribly much is going to change. And of course, the price of that may well be further horrible tragedies of the kind that we saw in November.
Right. And that's when we saw nearly all of the 30 people in an inflatable dinghy drown when their boat capsized in the English Channel. Robert, does it make any difference to point out how few migrants the UK takes in and gives asylum to compared to, say, France or, you know, other European countries?
It should change the debate, and it doesn't. The fact is that the UK is, by dint of geography, in a fairly privileged position. It doesn't have a land border that people are coming across, so it can afford to be isolated about this. So I don't think people do generally know that the French are taking far more people. It certainly doesn't seem to make a great deal of difference to the debate that that is happening. There is just a sense that the perfidious French are letting people flow across, and it's all the fault of the French. And the debate about this in the UK is not terribly well-rounded or well set up.
Are you hearing of any viable solutions? You know, in an ideal world with politics aside, is there anything London could do?
The thing that they could do, I think most dispassionate observers think, is set up safe and legal routes for people to come to the UK. The UK government has said it will do that, but the issue is there are just far more people seeking to come to the UK, and they're coming from a far wider range of places, and really there isn't a proper safe and legal route for them to come here. Something else that the UK could do that probably would make a difference would be to strike a new returns agreement with the European Union. So it could be sending some of those people back, but the UK is refusing to negotiate with the European Union. It keeps saying it's going to strike bilateral deals with countries. The countries in the European Union say, sorry, no, you have to deal with the European Union on this. And that's one of the things that's reached a standstill about all this.
Robert Wright is the FT's social policy correspondent. Now let's turn to Virgie Garaudan. She's a leading migrant expert and research director at the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris. She says domestic politics in France is also hampering efforts to negotiate a solution.
Well, one important factor is that France is in an election year. We have a presidential election in April. And being tough on borders, showing that you respect French sovereignty is important. And that cuts both ways. If the French president, Emmanuel Macron, is too nice with the British, his competitors will say that he's just a sheriff's deputy to the British. And at the same time, the dominant view in France among almost all candidates, except perhaps the Greens, is to be tough on migration. They want to be tough on migration, but they also want to be tough on the British. They don't want to say, oh, fine, we'll just take every migrant that arrives in Dover back to France.
And people in France also complain that Britain encourages migrants to cross the channel with its less restrictive labor laws. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The French are saying, in the UK, you can work without papers. There's a sort of economic attraction of the UK because they don't have the same kind of strict control of the labor force that exists in France, but also in other places such as Germany. And the UK also has entire sectors of its economy that welcomes foreign labor. So the French are also saying, don't blame us if people are going to the UK. They know there are jobs, and they know that it's easy to work without a work contract.
So what has France's strategy been?
So what they've tried to do now is to try to involve other member states of the European Union to try to say, this is not just a French problem with the UK, especially after Brexit. We should try to have an EU agreement with the UK on how to deal with this situation, trying to have a more comprehensive diplomatic solution. But the problem is that the UK so far has really not done anything except politicize the issue domestically. They're not willing to negotiate so much with the French. The only thing they've offered the French is more money. So basically giving a budget to the French to have more personnel on the ground, more police personnel, for instance. And that's it.
Virgie Gardin is a research director at the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris. Special thanks to the FT's Anna Gross for connecting us.
Well, quite a show we've had for you this evening. We look forward to being back in your company again, same time, same place tomorrow. Until then, cheerio.
You've been listening to the Power Hour, brought to you by the team at BizNews.